This is Armand DeMille with you with a positive mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. We also bring magic. We're in the middle of amazing changes here at WBAI. Part of those changes is the recent loss of some of our best producers, who were paid producers, radio hosts, including Esther Armagh and Hugh Hamilton, two people who I liked very much. But amazingly, right before these announcements, I invited Esther Armagh and I invited Hugh Hamilton to collaborate with me on a program that would be show a collaboration, because I like to show how we get together. And I invited Esther. Esther came in last week and we did something about sponsoring people. Now, Esther comes from the Ashanti, and these are people who are mentors. And I knew she had a lot to teach me about that, as well as I could collaborate with her. So last week with Julian Joyella, we created a program for you about mentoring and sponsoring, which I was going to play for you this week. But then when Esther was no longer on air, I pulled it back. But then when I heard people calling and saying, "Where is Esther? We want to hear Esther," I said, "Well, you got one more chance. And here it comes." So this morning I was hearing people lamenting the loss of Esther as a producer on WBAI in that 6 o'clock spot, as I feel the loss of her. But here I have her reflections on the work that meant the most of her: sponsoring people, mentoring people. So here's the program that we did. Many of us have children, and we've had to see our children go through changes, and sometimes you wonder, are you going to discipline them, give them a soft hand, help them out? But at times there are other people that you really see in some way you want to support, and they're in trouble. Our society tends not to provide as many opportunities for people to get a sponsorship, to get somebody who helps them through. So I wanted to talk about mentoring, aiding, sponsoring, and about what it's like to lend a hand to someone who may not know as much as you, or have as much fortune as you do, or as much knowledge as you do. But with me in the studio, just fortunately passing by, Esther Armagh, and wonderful producer at WBAI, is here. And she comes from a culture where mentoring is an essential part. So I thought this would be a great opportunity to bring you some of what Esther knows, and she's recently taken a whole bunch of people through. Let's go through this whole idea, Esther, of what it is to be. Well, first I want to start with this idea. My idea was that in most of the places in the world that may not be as lined up as we are here in America, what people do is that they support each other in some kind of way, but you're an elder, you know, and the elders take care of the youngers. And it was always the role of the elders to instruct the youngers. And if you achieve the position of elder later in your life, then your job is to teach before you walk off into the ice, you know, that's your last job. You are an elder, but you're not an elder at the same time, right? And no. So just run it down for me, okay? I'm going to leave it in your hands because you speak so beautifully well.
Well, it's good to be with you, Armand, back in the studio again in Midtown Manhattan. And so for me, I come from a culture where mentoring as a word doesn't even exist, mm-hmm. nor does it have a particular age range, a particular relationship, but it is simply the notion that you are part of a community and you have a role to play. And that is part of what it is to be in community. And it's really that simple. What that role is dependent on whatever skills you have. And so I remember as a kid, and even when I go home to Ghana, my family's Ghanaian, my mother is Ashanti, going home in the local hairdressers, you'd see like a 9-year-old, and her job is to hold the hand of the 7-year-old and make sure that he eats. And they may not have any blood relation. That just could be somebody from the village. It could be somebody else's kid. It could be, you don't know who it is. That's not the point. The point is, as another child, they are simply in your community. And so we do it differently. There's different types. There may be those you support And it's not about their fortune at all. It's just about being in community. There may be those you support who are in a particular need and need a particular type of support and nurturing to get through to the next stage of whatever their life is.
So you're saying that part of the structure of the community is automatically you take care of each other.
Absolutely.
It's an automatic.
Yeah, it's communal.
It's like you run around New York City, somebody gets hit by a bus, they're laying on the ground, the doctor's afraid to touch them because he's afraid he's going to get sued. This is not this way in Ghana.
No. Not. And I'm being specific. I'm talking about my tribe is Ashanti, and I'm talking about the village. Because the village mentality is part of how that country runs. And so whilst in all other kinds of ways it's messed up, communally, there is something very, very, very strong. Very, very, very strong. But the other type of nurturing that's important is the nurturing of brilliance. So it's not always about necessarily I found somebody who is in dire need and needs to be helped to the next stage. Often it's finding somebody who is particularly brilliant and nurturing the brilliance. And that is part of what it is to be in community. And so I definitely work with groups of mostly young women, but with emotional justice, definitely men as well. And people are all different stages. So we just had a young lady in here, Sarita Gates. Sarita Gates is brilliant. She is brilliant. She's a visionary and a leader. She's very, very young. And part of the culture that I come from is for people to occupy their brilliance, not to apologize for it, not to be self-deprecating about it, but to occupy it, to understand it, to think about what it is they're supposed to do, and not feel that there's some particular age they're supposed to arrive at before they come into the articulation of that brilliance, but to do it right now, because you're 22 or 21 or 25 is not the point. If you are brilliant, you are brilliant. And it's to not be intimidated, threatened, or want to subdue that brilliance, but to let it shine and be what it is it's supposed to be.
It's not to get that brilliance to work for you. It's to get
Absolutely
that brilliance not. To manifest, to work for itself.
Absolutely. Because the brilliance has nothing to do with you. Like, it's somebody else's reality, and it's you recognizing that that's just part of your work. And so I say all of that to say, the community I come out of is a supporter of all those different people in all those different ways.
So if people are broken, they get supported. If people are brilliant, what about if people are not brilliant?
Well, a lot of people are not brilliant.
Okay.
The point is support irrespective of your station. And so it's particularly and peculiarly Western to adopt a particular value to how you support. So where I'm from, there's just not a value. It's part of what it is to be in the community.
Is there somebody you don't support? I mean, what if they're criminal? What if they're psychopaths? What if there's somebody who's harmful? Is there somebody you
absolutely
you put outside the village? You say, hey.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's not that you support everybody, but it's also that you can't not support anybody. That's the point. Like, you can't simply, it's not a capitalistic environment that is so purely individualized in the way that it is here. And so that mentoring is not this particular and special thing that I came to understand it when I was that I was born in London and I was raised between two nations. Mentoring, when I heard it described, I just say, that's just what we do in the village. I don't understand what the big deal is. You know what I mean?
So you have recently sponsored, mentored a group of women of whose graduation you said you've gone to. When you say graduation from what?
College. So I've been, just to be clear, I've been sponsoring for over 20 years. I've been sponsoring for as long as I could, you know. When I was at school, I was sponsoring other kids.
How do you get sponsored by Esther? What's an Esther sponsor she like?
I mean, sometimes it's simply about you noticing somebody's particular ability or need and just offering a hand.
Okay,
like, it's not necessarily formal.
You, Esther, you've seen a couple of women, like the one woman you said was just out of prison. Right. What makes you say, what do? You go over and say, hey, let me give you a hand?
No, that's specific. So that type of mentoring for where I am here, because this is in New York.
Right.
So this is me saying I would like to work with young women who are have maybe had their first experience of incarceration. And the work is to move out of incarceration and turn your life around and move it in another direction. So I have a particular relationship with a specific project in New York where they are young women who've had their first experience or just their second experience of incarceration. And the idea is to turn them around from that life and offer them transferable skills. And so I use journalism and the media as life skills.
How do you do that?
So for me, it's the idea of how you put together a radio program are all transferable skills. So the notion of a goal, to start with an intention, an idea, to have to do the work to research it, to find out what it is you're going to do, to have to book guests to see something through to the next stage, to get to the point where you're on a microphone, are all steps that can be transferred into other areas of life. And so the young women are not necessarily in any way interested in doing radio or being a journalist or being in media. That's not the point. The point is for them to be present and engaged in the development of particular skills, but also to get a chance to express whatever their particular journey is, which is how we use the mic. We use the mic to enable them, to offer them the opportunity to tell their stories.
So they talk on radio?
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they just write. They don't want to necessarily talk on the radio, but some have definitely, a good number of them have.
So a number of these people, mostly women at this point who have been incarcerated, they come to you or you go to them and say, here's an opportunity. Right? Join me. I'll have you do some work or something.
Actually, the first time it happened, I had actually done an interview about the project on my radio show. Okay. And then as I learned about the organization, I said, oh, wow, I could really do some great work with this group. And so I went to them and said, I would be interested. What do you do? And so that's how that particular relationship developed. It's the most formal relationship I've ever had in terms of what you would describe as formal mentoring.
And so what does it take for you to do this?
Time.
How much time? What do you do?
With this group, it's a lot of time. It's a very specific allocated time. You've got to create protection mechanisms around them. They're young women. There's vulnerable situations. There's challenging family situations. And so with that mentoring, it's definitely about quality time, making sure that I have the time, that once I've committed, that I carve out the time, and that once you make the commitment, it is honored all the way through to the very end. So which is why going to a graduation is such a big deal, because you know where you started. You know that you're walking into someone's graduation who walked out of an incarcerated space, and now they've got their college diploma and they're moving on to the next stage of their life, and you've been a contributor to that journey. It's a very special thing. Like, I really, really love it. It's work and it's hard. And so, I definitely, with this particular group, it's about making the commitment, and I don't always make it. I don't always make it.
Sometimes you make it and stop, or sometimes you...
No, I assess whether I can make it. Like, the nature of the way that I work, I juggle 5-6 projects at a time.
Yeah, how do you juggle everything at once? How do you do that plus mentoring?
Well, for me, it's not difficult once I make the commitment, because I literally carve out the space. But it's the point of when I've made the commitment, and it depends how the other projects are working. So all the work that I do is media. So to me, it's not disconnected, because it's all media. But I am a playwright. I do a radio show. I write articles, and I do TV. And so it's just about, once I've made the decision that I'm then going to mentor someone, then I carve it into my day and into my space. But it's carved in time. And so I definitely have to take breaks, because I know that it's going to take time and work.
What would you say that your feeling about it is? Is there a maternal feeling that comes with this work when you're up there looking at somebody, the kind of pride of watching them graduate? Do you feel that this is a child of yours in some way?
No.
No? Does it feel like a sister of yours in some way?
No, I really, really just feel, I feel proud for their pride.
Right.
I feel, what I'm most happy about is that a young lady who has had a different relationship with herself that is not the most empowering, that is not the most inspiring, has discovered through this process her own strength. Because the kind of mentoring, I mean, I use the word, I kind of use it cautiously because I don't really use it, but the kind of mentoring that I'm interested in is that you discover your own ability, brilliance, power, talent, completely independent from me. So that you're not looking to me and seeing this is the person who saved my life. It's not that kind of relationship. That's not what I do. I'm interested in the person seeing for themselves their own reflection, and that this is who they always were. Even in the circumstances, challenging as it was, this is who you always were. And
how
so
exciting.
the point at which I see a young woman see that for herself is extraordinary to me, because you see genuine emotional independence.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to get to is the piece of you that you either, it's got to touch in either a maternal part, it's got to touch some piece of you.
It touches me emotionally, it touches me spiritually.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It absolutely does.
And you feel like your job is, this is what your job is, and you are complete. You're more complete because you do this.
I wouldn't characterize it that way. And the reason I resist that is I feel that you say that out of the place where you sit.
Yeah.
And because of how I'm culturally raised.
I know.
It's so intrinsic for me. I don't have that language. It's not that I feel more complete. I've simply always done it. I've not done something else.
You're not allowed to do something else, are you? If you didn't do it, if you ignored it, would it be a piece of you missing?
I've never not done it, so I don't know.
Yeah.
Like literally, I've never
Esther,
not done it.
Esther, this is me learning. So I'm not trying to put it into a box. I'm trying to learn from you.
Yeah, no,
an experience
I appreciate that
you have, that's a remarkable experience, and the way that you do it, the way I do it is quite differently.
Yeah.
But the way you do it has this kind of a very spiritual sense to it. It's almost like there's an existential consciousness that you're a piece of and all of these people are a part of. And that you bring it, you just allow it to exist. You don't do much. It's not your power. It's not your strength.
No.
It's like you're a piece of it.
Yeah. And it's because it's the idea that you're part of a community and that you're raised, you're raised with understandings. You know, it's the idea that an elder would say to you as a young person that if you were ever in need and you met you, would that be a good experience and a bad one, depending on what you've been willing to do for someone else?
Did you know Marilyn Ferguson? Do you know who she was? She wrote The Aquarian Conspiracy.
No.
A friend of mine had quite a vision. And her vision was kind of similarly that she was going to bring... She took a group of 20 different people, and she said, these are the 20 most brilliant people. And she did a roadshow. Just took these people around town, and they were doing... They would just appear and talk in front of audiences. It was like TED.com, but she was sponsoring. And she always proposed that there be a more humanistic way of doing everything.
Right.
You could take this and try to put this into a concept of, if we took this and put it into a concept of an organization, like even a radio program, what would this organization look like with you being program director, for example? If you were meant to guide, if you were the chief of the village, if you were in charge of something, what would it look like? How would it be?
That's interesting. I mean, I've often been in charge.
I know.
So what would it look like?
So what if we gave you, if we came up with the funding and said, Esther, would you please, we got to have something going here. Would you please run this now? How are you going to make it work if you're going to use your concept of allowing people to manifest their own brilliance in their own way and encouraging them in their own way? Can you even imagine that in an entity?
Yes, because I've been an executive producer of big teams in other countries.
Sure.
And so I've literally had to be somebody who develops other people's talent. So I've done that in a much more formal, structured way, and it's been really rewarding to do that.
What happens when you run into the irrational who want to interfere with what you're doing?
Well, the nature of any structure is the presence of conflict.
Right.
The question is how you navigate that conflict. I mean, it depends on what it is. It depends on what you're defining as irrational. It depends on what the demands are or the requests are of whatever that thing that you run into is, whether or not they can be met and both people can get something, as opposed to the requirement with the negotiations as we do them, which is one person must win and one person must lose. And as long as that is the beginning point of your intention, then the only thing you're going to end up with is more conflict.
Do you imagine, knowing who you are, that if you were in that position, that you would have difficulty with that position? Or do you imagine, no, I would just have to deal with this the way I deal with everything. I would have to find my ways in.
But I think difficulty is a natural part of leadership.
I know, but would you mean difficulty to the point of feeling frustrated and not wanting to do it?
I'm sure I would get incredibly frustrated, and I'm sure I would have moments when I might not want to do it. But that doesn't mean I would like necessarily stop doing it. Like, I've run things, so I know that I've come into those spaces.
So you believe that you could just about, if you had to, make something work?
Absolutely.
And that's a very important statement we're saying here, because I believe I can make something work. You believe you can make something work. And you believe that there's a basic fairness about you. Right? And so if there's anything that has to be done, and you have to use people in some way to do it, you don't need what people usually do, which is trickery, tomfoolery, subcontracts, all this other stuff. Do you believe there's a way of running something that could be really upfront?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's painful when we see it not that way, isn't it?
And I think when we see it not that way, it has to do, everything to do with our own intimate relationship with power and powerlessness.
Good. Just talk to me about that.
Because I think that if you experience yourself as contributing in the world, as having something important to give, as having something that matters to the world and that is worth something, then I don't necessarily think your instinct is to negate somebody else's worth. And I think conflict arises primarily because of our own intimate relationship with power and powerlessness. It has so little to do with the other person. But the other person may be a trigger. They may be the manner in which the conflict arises. So then it becomes this huge thing that it need not be. And there's often a basic dishonesty. You don't call it by its name. You call it something else. And then you claim you're trying to resolve one thing, and that's really not what you're trying to resolve, or it's not resolution at all. It's about power. The loss of it, the acquisition of it, the maintenance of it. And that causes the kind of conflict that can become irreconcilable.
If you have, in any given situation, you and I, or you, can see the fairness of it, you could see what's going on, you could probably deal with just about any situation. When mentoring, when you have people who you're trying to encourage to go to some new place in life, to take an adventure, it takes something to get people to take a chance.
It does, and I think it also takes recognizing that everybody won't go and everybody won't take a chance.
Yeah.
And part of leadership is recognizing when to let go and to stop. Recognize that there is nothing more you can do, that you've done all that you can.
And you let it go.
And then you just let it go.
Wow. Have you had to do that often?
Absolutely. And more often than I would have ever liked. But those are the hardest lessons, most definitely, especially when you've invested or you believe you see something and the other person doesn't see it. And that's your own control. It's sometimes your own ego. And you have to navigate that. That's when you're younger, you're navigating those spaces, and you have to learn that the letting go and that the person's choice to be where they are, that is a separation from you. That is not necessarily about you.
You've got some talent. You know, Esther, I've always enjoyed. Do you think that you're an unusual person?
No.
You are. If you think there are a lot of people who you're just like one of many.
Well, I mean, I come from a place where I'm not unusual. So I mean, where I come from, clearly it's regular.
See, I'm not saying great, special, fantastic, or anything. Just unusual thinking, and it's beautiful to see unusual thinking. Marilyn Ferguson's group included Ted Turner, Jacques Cousteau, Jane Fonda, a number of just unusual people who were like unusual folks,
right?
And she would like to gather the unusual folks because they had some different way of seeing the world. Your way of seeing the world sounds very, it makes a lot of sense. But I don't know many people who have the power to pull it off, and you do. And I like that. I like it. Thank you.
I like it too.
Thank you for what you do in this world. Thank you. It's a nice thing.
Thank you for what you do in this world. So can I ask you some questions now about how you mentor?
Sure, sure, sure.
So how did you even start to mentor? Like, you were talking about specifically working with men. How did that even start?
It started with an early research on men that I did, having seen the essence of what it is for most men to have ineffective fathers. Ineffective, absent, or brutal fathers. One of the three. With very few decent people around to be fathering, right? And what I kept seeing in men over and over again is that they have, that they're acting out with this missing father is present in everything they do. Every relationship they have, they're either acting their father out or being their father or being anti-father. Every relationship they have with authority, with business, it's all contaminated. by this missing element. I have no dad. So I don't want to be anybody's dad, but I notice all it takes to be somebody's father is to say, you're okay. The way you are, this is the way you are. I accept the way you are. You can be whatever you are, and I will accept that. And I may not agree with it, but I will accept it, and I could love you the way you are. And I found one at a time men would just be coming by, you know, and joining me and wanting to talk to me because there's nobody to talk to. They can't talk to their wives because their wives get an investment. They can't talk to their best friends because their best friends get jealous. So this thing happened, and then I formed a thing called a men's group where a bunch of men got together, and I watched them boil as they became friends together. And little by little, I kept seeing that a man without a man friend is almost can't exist in this world. You just can't do it alone, and you can't do it just focusing on the opposite sex and trying to be with women as well. So men have tears, and if a man allows himself his tears, and he does that with pride, he becomes a bigger person.
So how does mentoring those men, like, what does it feed for you, in you?
All right, such a beautiful question. It's kind of, you know, it's a similar thing to what the radio does. The radio program does when I get feedback from some foreign country that says, I heard you talk about this thing and it made a real difference for me. It makes me feel, I could go this way. Oh, that's great. Thank you, Esther. That's a beautiful question, because it's like the dots come together. It's like what you were talking about before. It's not that I feel complete, but I feel that there's a wholeness that I could feel when somehow this happens, this work happens, when somebody like even Julian or somebody becomes more of who they are and they show me that. It makes me, it's a solid feeling. It's a nice feeling. And it's not what I was thinking before when you said, you know, using the terms complete. It's not that, oh, I've done my job, or pride. In fact, it has less pride and more humility than anything else involved in it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. So when is it at its most challenging?
When there's a door. And behind the door, when somebody has this basic distrust, which I expect everybody to have, you know, I absolutely distrust, and then that distrust manifests just right before the person feels that they're going to open the door, right? When a person gets really, I'm not going to let you in, 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 all right, I'll let you in, now I'm going to kill you. It's right before then. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel really surprised and shocked that somebody has to, you know, that they're really, really get terrified for that moment. And I don't recognize it. It'll come out in some behavior. Like, I'm going to take a vacation and I'm not going to be coming around to the group for 3 weeks for no particular reason. My wife says we can't afford it. You know, something like that. Right before the breakthrough, I feel sad. I feel sad. That's when it becomes a challenge. Right. And I try to, and of course I work through that as well.
So how has discovering that work and then doing that work, how has it changed you? Like, how has it shaped you emotionally, like as a man yourself?
Mm-hmm. I think it's that, like, it didn't shape me, but we all shaped together. You know, that I was shaping as a man as I became that, because I had silly ideas of what a man was. This is Armand DeMille with you. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to an earlier recording of Armand DeMille and Esther Armand talking about mentoring, sponsoring. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a short while.
Round, like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning, on an ever-spinning reel. Like a snowball down a mountain, or a carnival balloon, like a carousel that's turning, running rings around the moon, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face. And the world is like an apple whirling silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind, like a tunnel that you follow to a tunnel of its own, down a hollow to a cavern where the sun has never shone, like a door that keeps revolving in a half-forgotten dream, like the ripples from a pebble someone tosses in a stream, like a clock whose hands are sweeping past the minutes of its face. And the world is like an apple running silently in space, like the circles that you find in the windmills of your mind. Keys that jingle in your pocket, words that jangle in your head. Why did summer go so quickly? Was it something that you said? Lovers walk along the shore, leave their footprints in the sand. Is the sound of distant drumming just the fingers of your hand? Pictures hanging in a hallway and the fragment of a song. I've remembered names and faces, but to whom do they belong? When you knew that it was over, you were suddenly aware that the autumn leaves were turning to the color of a hair. Round, like a circle in a spiral, like a wheel within a wheel, never ending or beginning, on an ever-spinning reel, as images unwind. Like the circles that you find. In the windmills of your mind. In the windmills of your mind. In the windmills of your mind.
This is Armand DeMille. You're listening to a collaboration between me and Esther Armand about mentoring. This is Armand DeMille with Esther Armand. We are looking at this whole idea of sponsoring people, mentoring people, and so on and so forth. What does it require? If you, Esther, if you could think of a student, and you could think of somebody who we would or you could help, what do you see? What are the essential elements?
For me, the most essential thing is a willing spirit.
They have to be willing.
Have to be willing.
You have to be willing.
You have to be willing to be wrong. You have to be willing to be made mad and to calm down. You have to be willing to meet your own ego and quell it for the good of whoever that person that you're mentoring is. I actually think it's so interesting that people ask about mentees and what they are willing to do. And I think the work is for the mentor to do. And part of the work is the separation of ego and intention in terms of working with that person. So that, because it's so easily a codependent situation. It can so easily become something where you become this person's savior, intentionally or otherwise. All of those things are so easily done. And it's your willing spirit for it to not become that.
Well, there's a bunch of people listening right now, Esther, who are saying, I would like to be Esther's mentee. And there's going to be a whole bunch of, no matter what their age, they don't have to be incarcerated. What if they all jump up and say, hey, Esther, would you mentor me?
And I would probably say no. I would suggest somebody else who might be able to. But I'm not, like, I mentor really intentionally. You know, I really think about.
You select what you do.
Definitely I do.
Okay, now what do you select is what I'm asking for. You select, we talked about you, but you select certain people because
yes,
you're
do.
Looking for something. What is, do you mind saying which what it is?
Two things. One is brilliance and one is need. So on the one hand, you are literally, you're brilliant, especially for your young.
What does brilliant mean?
That you have specific and particular gifts.
Intellectually.
Intellectually, creatively.
You got to be able to think.
You definitely have to be able to think.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I don't know that I know how to help you.
Okay,
I don't know how to nurture.
You can't be somebody who just says, you know, life is everything you see and there is nothing, you know, I have no imagination.
You can be, but I'm not going to mentor you.
Okay, so you want somebody with imagination.
Absolutely.
If you have imagination, what about depression?
I've certainly mentored people who have depression and have found it really incredibly hard.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. And I'm not, you know, I'm very clear that I am not professionally trained. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm very clear about what I can do, but I also am clear about where I can't go. So I've also had situations where I've ended up with people who have a clinical diagnosis and I've had to step away and say, this I cannot do.
What do you mean? A clinical diagnosis.
Like they have a diagnosis of a mental health issue and they may be on medication.
So there's something, you get people who are really strange in some way and they have some aberrant mind and you look at that and you say, oh, wait, paranoid schizophrenia, this person's paranoid, I'm not going to do with that. I'm not going to go with the real bends, right? Real terrible stuff, right? I want somebody who feels within the range of okay, plus they have to have a kind of a positive attitude. And they want to grow, and they have to be smart.
Yeah.
Right? That's
yeah.
what you require.
Yeah.
What about physically healthy?
I mean, I'd rather that you were. I think I've worked with people who are not physically healthy. But define physical health.
I don't know. You know, like within a range of normalcy. Not too fat, not too skinny.
Oh, I mean, I don't pay any attention
to that. You don't care.
To that.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And habits, their habit of living. If they have children, is it okay? Can you mentor people who have children? That's a tough thing.
Yeah, no, I have.
It's tough.
Yeah, that's definitely tough. I mean, it's tough because you've got to figure out time. And if you have a child, then if a person has a kid, the way you mentor is just different.
How about financial need? What about their desperation and financial need? How do you help somebody? They have to be able to support themselves?
Well, I've definitely mentored people who are really, really struggling. You know, I've mentored people who are, you know, living in shelters and...
Okay, that's important. And even in shelters,
parents.
You could mentor in shelters. It doesn't matter.
But the thing about 21st century mentoring is that it's different than pre-technology. Because part of mentoring is through social media at this point. There's all kinds of ways that... Because certainly for me, what I have learned about the significance of mentoring is connection. That somebody requires a connection and for the connection to stay. There's all kinds of ways you can maintain that. If you have a kid, you can be on a telephone, you can be Twitter chatting,
That's right.
You know, there's all kinds of ways to maintain the connection. But the point is that the connection is maintained, and certainly with young people who are going through particularly challenging times, that a door is always left open, no matter how challenging the circumstance that has been created between you.
Modern technology really help you in your efforts with people?
Very much so.
Being able to have all of that available?
Yeah, I use all of it.
You use all of it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I use all of it. And it's... and then there are times when a face-to-face conversation is an irreplaceable thing. So there are, there will be face-to-faces, you know, a conversation person-to-person, being able to look into somebody's eyes, look into someone's face, feel energy, do what I call learn how to navigate someone's silence, be able to sit in someone's energy. Those are all irreplaceable things as well.
Tell me a story about somebody who graduated, not graduated, but symbolically graduated, a success of someone who went from the worst place to the best possible place. Do you have a particular person in mind? It doesn't have to mention their name, or is there a one that really touches you when you think about it?
Yeah, as a young girl, I think she was maybe 15, 16, and she'd been in and out of foster care. And... her mother was having a challenging time with a guy who was dealing. And she had a brother by, so she, her brother was this guy's son, and they were from the Caribbean, and this young girl and her mother were in New York, and the man and the woman had come together. They had another kid, and they went through a challenging time, and the mother put the young girl and her brother in foster care. And she then ended up in the incarceration system and then with this project, which is where I first met her. And so I remember meeting her and just seeing just fragility and a fragility wrapped in aggression. And recognizing that I could see the fragility even through the aggression, and that the work for me was to always speak to the fragility, even where I saw the aggression, even when it was directed at me. That's really hard, like, to really look at someone's heart when you can see their level of their rage and know that it's not real rage. And then she started to write, beautiful young writer, found her own voice, and would come and do homework with me all the time, and took a lot of time. Finally came out of foster care, was able to go back into the school system, then had another situation with the mother. Then the father left New York and went back to the Caribbean, and then took her brother, who was her only real close family unit. So then there was another issue. She was put back into foster care. So we were doing mentoring all throughout this time. And she just decided she wanted to quit school because it was just all too much dealing with, I would say probably dealing with depression, although never diagnosed in any particular way. And was navigating some serious weight challenges, was really eating her feelings. And it was just staying. Staying was such a big part of what mattered when everybody else is leaving. And it was work. You know, it was work. It's not always about a conversation. It wasn't always about talking. It was definitely about staying. It was
What was the end light?
The end light was she graduated college and she's employed and she lives in Harlem now.
Wow.
And I saw her just the other day. Like, and it's almost weird to look at someone and think, I almost don't recognize who you were. And I love that we don't have a mentor relationship anymore. She saw me on the street. She gave me a big hug. She's out. She's got her gig. She's working. She's engaged in her life. She's reconnected back with her brother. Her mother left the dude. And she's in her life, occupying her life. I'm looking at this young woman standing, shoulders back. Those things that I saw, I don't see anymore. I don't feel a fragility when I'm standing in her energy. She hugs me. You know, how are you doing? Thank you. It's a quick exchange. And she moves on. She's moved on with her life. And so part of the success is the end of our relationship. So it's the idea that we think of breakups as such a sad time. And for me, they are an indication of success.
It's like when you have kids and your kid finally goes off.
Yeah.
You know, it's part of your success, not part of your failure. But let me ask you, if you're not going to be a mentor, but you're going to be a parent, there are things that you know about parenting that you wish parents knew. There are things you know from the way that you live and the way that you've mentored that you wish parents could know. And I know you don't like to preach or anything like that, but what would you love most parents to get from what you've learned about what it is to support a human through life?
See, but I think the mere fact of not being connected by blood always makes that such an easy conversation to have. And it's so different if I was ever in that experience. I've never been a parent.
Okay, so. but try. Try. Give it to me because I could give you some. I mean, you know, I've already said some. Look at your child with a different attitude. What are the eyes that you would hope parents would put on the children, even the children that you've seen that you've recovered?
Well, I would literally say, and I just know from the experience, is what a child wants to be seen first and foremost.
What does that mean?
That you see that they are there physically in a space. And I mean beyond that they are a head and shoulders and arms and legs, but that you see them. So that I know from the experience, this young lady who ended up, you know, graduating and she's now doing good, sitting with her, her unhappiness was like waves, like it came off her body. But I remember when I met her family, I met her mother, I met the guy. When she graduated from the project, they came. So I met them and I understood what she was navigating. And that was, you know, a parent who wasn't present to any part of her emotional self.
You know how that manifests? It's kind of an interesting thing. It manifests in a curiosity. If you have a curiosity about your kid, like, who are you? Right? That's where the seeing them is. It's not just I see who you are because I'm seeing you through my own filtered eyes. I'm seeing you through what I'm afraid you're going to get me in trouble. You've got to get your grades. But who are you?
But how hard is that?
It seems very hard for parents.
Well, I've never been a parent, so I think it's so hard to even analyze that because you have no idea what's triggered in you when you create another being.
Absolutely.
When you think about whatever all your own experiences of your own childhood, whatever your traumas survived and repressed may be, however they may manifest, what might be triggered, I just think you have no idea who you will become when you're a parent, and you will be surprised at your own self.
Right. And when you get up there, it gets so easy to turn off that one question, looking at your child and saying, who are you?
Well, the question was it ever turned on for yourself?
Well, if it's not, yeah. Maybe by listening to this show today, people may get a little curious and say, maybe put up a little note over the crib.
That, where else could you really have this conversation on the air and have anybody listen to it?
Where else is right?
Irreplaceable space. Not a mic, but a moment.
Nice. Thank you very much, Esther.
Thank you, Armand Demel.
All right. Good to speak to you. See you again.
Okay, take it.
There was an interesting book a long time ago called Meeting with Remarkable People. Remarkable people, remarkable people. What are remarkable people like? Unusual folk. Everybody has their own way of being. You know, everybody is unique. We could all say that. We could say nobody's special, so on and so forth. But there are just some people that stand out as great. Great. You don't have to really go far to look at, you know, who are some of those people. Like, if you think about Steve Jobs, for example, and I hate to glorify anybody, but this was no normal human walking around the planet. This is a special kind of guy. Special message, special something, affected people in a certain way. I'm not so sure Barack Obama is a special guy, but he is a special guy. You could see it. There's something unusual. There's something even in the way he dances. I'm not saying we should be dedicated to these folks, but, you know, I talked to you after talking to Esther Armand. I look at her and I go, what an unusual person. What an unusually gifted, beautiful human being she is. I feel that way about a lot of people that I'm close to. My friends, I think of that about, you know, my young cousin Julian who works with me. He's what an unusual man. He's got these unusual talents, these unusual abilities, this flexible mind, creative stuff. Proud. You become, it's really wonderful to be around them. I look at myself. I know I'm weird. I know I'm unusual. I know I'm strange. I know I have perceptions that are not ordinary. But when we meet remarkable people, when we see the remarkable people, you know, we can, it's not that we should take them and put them aside and say, oh, point to them. And it's just a gift. I remember once a friend of mine going to a concert to see somebody back in the 80s. I think he was going to one of the Jefferson Airplane or something like that. And I said, why are you going so far out of the way to go to that concert? He said, because I can't imagine that there would have been a concert that they were in that I missed. He said, I want in my lifetime to be able to have seen them. It's like seeing Michael Jackson live or seeing Madonna live or seeing Talking Head live. It's like going to concerts, you get a chance to see the remarkable, the special, the unusual. That's why they call them concerts. Now, in every person I know, I can find a kernel of that uniqueness. What Esther was saying before is that if you look at a child, she says, what do I know about being a parent? I'm not a parent. Of course, she is a parent. Listen to her. She parents so many people, right? She is in so many ways, as a mentor, she is doing her own parenting. But when you think about what she's saying to parents, would you please look at your child and see who they are and see their being? She's saying, would you please be curious about them? And would you recognize that each one of them is unique and remarkable? Now, if we take a child early on in life and we spend all our life telling that child that they're special, we wind up killing them. It's a horrible thing to do to children. Parents do it all the time. They say it to kids, you're special, you're special, you're special, you're special. No, you shouldn't tell your child that they're special. You shouldn't tell them, because then they're going to feel like freaks. Then they're going to feel like they deserve certain things that other people don't deserve. No. What you need to do is recognize that your child is special. Recognize their uniqueness. Not tell them about their uniqueness, but to honor it in some way. Which means if they have an idea that sounds unusual, you think about it and you say, what an interesting idea. What an interesting way of being. I'll tell a story about David. David and I were once walking in some park in some part of Long Island. We were in the park and I was wearing leather shoes. And he wanted to have lunch, and there was a little island. And he said, look, we could skip over those rocks and go on that island. David was like 12. And I said, I can't skip over those rocks, David, because my leather shoes will make me fall into the lake. And he said, you old fuddy-duddy. He said, he called me a fuddy-duddy. And I thought to myself, well, David has an idea. Why don't I just go with his idea, and I'll skip over the rocks, and I'll go. And I fell right in the lake. I fell in the lake, and I'm sitting in my up to my waist in lake water. And I realized this is the worst that could happen if I follow his suggestion. The worst that happens is I'm sitting in a lake laughing at myself. So often in life, we refuse to see the creativity, the beauty, the essence of somebody who may have an idea that's different than ours, because we get stuck in our own fears. What a parent could do, a parent can look down and say, who are you? Don't you wish your mother had said that to you? Don't you wish your father had looked at you at one point and said, who are you? Who are you really? Tell me about you. It might have actually helped you delve into the inside of you to ask the question, who am I? Now, what happens to many people by the time they get to me, Armand DeMille, and they get to me, you know, for counseling, is I'm asking the question, who are you? And they say, well, I don't know how to get there. I don't know how to find out who I am. Because nobody ever really asked that question before. The only time people ever asked the question about who I am is they were trying to control me or do something with me. Well, I found a way. One of the ways to find out who you are is to ask the question, who are you not? Who are you not? Who of the life that you're leading now are you not? What are you doing that you really don't feel you're connected to and you would want to be doing? By peeling away the layers of the onion, as you kind of take off the layers of who you're not, eventually a kernel appears, and that appears, that gets you closer to who you are. So that's the work I do. The work I do in mentoring and sponsoring people is to help them find out who they are, by helping them discover who they're not. But the essence for all of you with each other is to ask the question, to look at someone you love, and with real curiosity to reach down inside you and say, hey, who are you? Who are you? And be willing to accept anything you hear. Be willing to accept anything you see. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. I've got to be going. It has been fun being with you, especially fun being with Esther Armach, WBAI. And so that's it, my friends. That's that wonderful collaboration between me and Esther Armach. You can keep this if you want to hear Esther, you want to send it to your friends. You can just download it yourself. Go to the website, thepositivemind.com. It'll be up there, or go to WBAI.org. Esther, I'm sure one day will be back with us again. And I'm really proud to have done this work with her. And be sure to tune in again next week when we're going to be bringing you information about, number one, headaches, migraine headaches, and a perception of pain that nobody has, something that people do not understand. If you know somebody with migraines, line them up, make sure that they'll be listening next Tuesday at 1 p.m. And on Wednesday, we're going to be talking about reality checks. Very intriguing program about what is real and what is not real. This is Armand DeMille. If you go to my website, thepositivemind.com, or send me an email through armand@thepositivemind.com. My thanks to everybody. We'll be back with you again soon, my friends. Bye-bye for now.
This is listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, bringing you news, information, and programming meant to empower you. We need your support. If you go to our website, wbai.org, and press the donate button, for as little as $10 a month, you can become a sustaining member. You'll be making a tax-deductible contribution that helps us help you by bringing you truth in radio.
ਨਾ ਮੈਂ ਬੈਠਣ ਨਾ ਵਿੱਚ ਪਾਉਣ।